So I wanted to start today by discussing very briefly linear programming, mainly just to indicate that it reduces to a matrix problem. Alright, so linear programming is a sort of classic important field of, I guess, computer science or computational mathematics, and it is typically illustrated by transportation problems. Linear programming is used extensively in the airline industry and other types of transportation industries. And so we have on this foil here a sort of classic simple example. So here you are, you're running a organization, I mean, Kmart or Sears or something. So you have a bunch of retail outlets and you have a bunch of warehouses. And you need to properly schedule the transfer of material from warehouses to retail outlets in a way that minimizes your cost or maximizes your time taken or the cost it takes, which are probably roughly the same thing. So obviously we want to make certain that we take the material where possible from the nearest warehouse to a given outlet, but maybe a given warehouse doesn't have enough of that item or something. So it can be formulated mathematically in the way we stated here. This would be in a real problem summed over products, but here we just take one product. So we have we specify a certain number of units at each warehouse. So you know you'd have five packets of cornflakes at warehouse 1, 10 at warehouse 2, 500 at warehouse 3, and so on. Then each outlet, you specify the number they need, 15 at retail store 1, 12 at retail store 2, and so on. And then you want to determine some numbers xij, which are the number of each product shipped from warehouse I to outlet J. And we assume that the cost of each shipping is some number Cij, which is roughly going to be the fuel cost or proportional to the fuel cost and whatever other cost is involved in transportation. It's obviously big if they're a long way away, and small if they're just next to each other. So the goal in life is to minimize the sum over I and J of Cij times Xij. That's the total cost of this shipment. Now this shipment, it has to satisfy certain constraints. And these constraints are both inequalities and equalities. So there's an inequality. That if I sum over all outlets of Xij, that which is essentially the total number of items taken out of warehouse I, that must be less than or equal to the number originally in warehouse I. So I have the sum from j equals 1 to n of xij is less than or equal to ai. The other constraint I have is that I must ship the right number. So the sum over over xij from I equals 1 to m, which is therefore the total number shipped to detailed outlet j, must be bj. So this mathematical problem says minimize given objective function subject to a set of equalities and inequalities. There's also an implicit inequality that the XIJs are positive, and also that they're integer. It's not terribly useful to find a solution where you ship half a packet of cornflakes from one warehouse and 5.5 from another, even if that is the actual solution mathematically. So linear programming is characterized by a set of forms which are linear. Notice all these are linear. The Cij, Xj is linear. Xij less than or equal to ai is a linear constraint, and we have a linear equality, Xij equals bj. So linear programming is the study of optimization with linear things. And it has is often characterized by wanting integer solutions. So now we diligently go on to FOIL 47. The intermediate FOILs discuss all sorts of other types of optimization, including, for instance, ones like chi-squared, which is typically often called a least squares minimization, and that is characterized by being certainly not linear, it's quadratic or possibly nonlinear. So linear program is actually a very special case. Most optimization problems are not linear. Actually, you often saw, because essentially all other interesting optimization problems are so-called NP-complete, which means there are no polynomial solutions, whereas linear programming has polynomial solutions. Often, you approximate nonlinear problems by linear problems and use linear programming. So here on FOIL 47, we first restate the problem, and we have a slightly different notation because we've gone from two variables, I and J, to a single variable because there's no value at this stage in preserving the fact that the indices partly correspond to outlets and partly to warehouses. So we have a linear sum to be minimized subject to a set of linear constraints. Now the first thing you notice is that you can convert all these constraints from inequalities to equalities. And you do that by introducing new variables. So that's illustrated here for, say, the first constraint, whereas assume the first constraint is a greater than or equal to constraint, and so we want to have that the sum from j equals 1 to r of aij xj minus b1 is greater than or equal to naught, so we just set that equal to x of r plus 1. Where so far we only have x of 1 through x of r, so this is a new variable, and it's just defined by this linear form. So now if we swap things around, we see that this inequality can be written as an equality as the sum from j equals 1 to r of aij xj minus x to the r plus 1 equals b of 1, which means that if we now make the x's run from 1 to r plus 1 instead of from 1 to r, we reduce it to the previous form where the inequalities become an equality. Coefficient a1r plus 1, which is the coefficient of x to the r plus 1 in the first equation, is minus 1. All the other a of ir plus 1 is 0. X to r plus 1, x sub r plus 1 does not enter into the minimization function, so c of r plus 1 is 0. So by diligently introducing new variables, we can actually assume that linear programming is minimize a linear form subject to a set of linear equalities. And so we can write this in matrix form, AX equals B, with the as the constraints, with what we want to minimize is this thing I call the z equals c dotted into x. Okay. So this next file, which is 48, makes a claim that you can show that the set of x's satisfying the constraints of a so-called convex region. Convex regions are regions which are not like the ones I've drawn. A convex region is such that if I take any two points in the region, join them by a line, all points in that line are inside the region. So if I take a circle, take any two points in a circle, and join them by a line, those points are in a circle. So it's sort of what you mean by convex. It's the curve is pointing outwards. The surface is always pointing outwards, because the reason it's non-convex at the top right hand of this picture is because I have a dip, so that if I take points and sort of the two spikes that are coming out here and join them by a line, that points in the middle, which are not in the region. So you can easily show, just mathematically, that that the solutions of a linear programming problem, the solution of the constraint is a convex region, and then you can you define so-called extreme points, which are points where which are not in between any other points. So these are just the isolated sharp edges of the region. You can show that rigorously that the optimal solution, if it exists, of the linear programming problem is a so-called extreme point of the convex region. All right, so in the next foil, we state the answer to the problem. And actually, the first line is the most important. Namely, it looks at this matrix equation, matrix constraint AX equals B. Now, notice that you cannot trivially invert this equation and say, solve x equals a to the minus 1b, because there are typically many, many more x's than there are rows of this equation. So the number of rows is the number of constraints. So typically you have many fewer constraints than you have unknowns, and there's actually a misprint in the current version of this foil. When it says n minus m, it should say r minus m on the second bullet. So you can show that the extreme points satisfy that the solution is is such that they're actually very simple, but essentially nearly every element of X is zero, and they're just M non-zero elements, where M is the number of constraints. Thank you. What's this? Okay, let's turn those out. Do they have to do them now? Okay, that's good. All right. So you can show that that the solutions are such that you have m non-zero elements and r minus m zeros, where say R is typically much bigger than M. So that says that the solution of a linear programming problem is essentially can be thought of as trying to find out which elements of X to put to zero and which elements not to put to zero. And so the typical solution method, which is given the name of the simplex method, which is one of the best methods, essentially moves from one so-called extreme point to another, which it does by just successively making different choices as to which elements of X are zero and which are non-zero in the solution. It then calculates the resultant cost function and see which is the minimum. So what implications does this have for computational science? And so you'll read a bunch of papers studying parallel computing for linear programming. And so this is actually a very hard parallel program. The reason why it's a very hard parallel program is that the basic step is not very computationally intensive. It's called making a different choice for one row, doing a little bit of computation, and then moving to another choice. And so if you do any sort of standard parallel algorithm, you'll find a very low computation to communication ratio. The reason is, I say, that most of these most of the elements of any row are actually zero anyway, so you don't do much. Most constraints are very simple. They just involve a few of the elements. And so actually, linear programming is one of the hardest algorithms to parallelize. Another interesting feature of linear programming is we've sort of studied in partial differential equations sparse matrices, because the matrix corresponding to a partial differential equation is sparse. Now, the differential equations you get in PDEs are structured. Namely, the elements of the non-zero are very clearly labeled. There's one column, there's the diagonal, the lines parallel to the diagonal, just near the diagonal, and then there's some very definite structure as to where the non-zero elements are. And this allows you to write extremely efficient algorithms. If you think about these miserable constraints, which unfortunately represent the real world, you know, that you have a constraint involving if you have the airline industry, you want to make certain that your flight crew can actually arrive at Syracuse in time, then, you know, there's Jane who lives in Watertown and Fred who lives in Utica, and you have to put in the cost of their transportation, and they've all got to get to Elmira or Syracuse or wherever they're going to. And so what does that mean? It says that the structure of these constraints are very sparse, because they tend to involve, in this case, there are only a few members of the crew, so the constraint is something that these crew have to arrive at the same place at the same time to be able to fly the aircraft, and they're very obscure in terms of their structure, because they reflect very real-world features about the nature of air crews or the nature of the arrangement of the U.S. Air flight plan, which is hardly very structured. It's very it's got some features, but it is not a regular structure. It's very irregular. And so you'll find these matrices are very peculiar matrices. They have no structure because they reflect the reality of the problem you're solving. So the net result of this is that these matrices are extremely difficult to decompose efficiently because of this lack of structure. So you can't do natural parallel decompositions very easily. And even when you do a parallel decomposition, you find it hard to do anything because of the low amount of computation. So the bottom line is that actually, as far as I know, nobody does linear programming in parallel. And the reason is that they've actually managed to find such fast sequential algorithms that they can get away without solving it in parallel. So currently, although there was a lot of activity about 5 to 8 years ago looking at parallel linear programming, as far as I know, nobody has a terribly good algorithm for reasons that are almost impossible to get around because they reflect the nature of the problem. But fortunately for the airlines, and unfortunately for computer science and the vendors of parallel machines, you do not need to solve these in parallel. But linear programming is certainly one of the better examples of an unstructured sparse matrix, because the sparsity is certainly not geometrical. It has geometrical features because it reflects the geometrical structure of the distribution system of a given when you're doing a transportation problem, but it has no regularity. So we're now finished these foils. You have to enroll in CPS 713 to do the rest of these foils. Alright. But now we're going to discuss, as the last topic, full matrices. So, which actually, in retrospect, I should have probably done earlier. Alright, so we'll actually only cover matrix multiplication in any detail. And the only other thing we'll do is matrix inversion, which is effectively LU decomposition. So the first thing we're going to do is discuss what applications need full matrices. So the first point we obviously want to make, which sort of links to our previous discussion of linear programming, is that of course in partial differential equations, which is the dominant source of matrices in computer science, those matrices which correspond to these differential operators are sparse, namely most of the elements are zero. So a full matrix is by definition a matrix where inverted commas essentially all the elements are non-zero. What it means operationally is they're matrices that when you write the code to process them, you pay no attention as to whether the element is zero or non-zero. In most floating point units, it takes as much time to add zero to A as it does to add 3.14159, etc. to A. And it is no faster adding zero to A than anything else. So you can always take care of zeros. You can add them or multiply them. Floating point units give the right answer. They give the answer zero, of course. They give you zero for multiplication, and they leave the number unaltered if you add to it. So full matrix algorithms, which are in fact often applied to matrices which are sparse or have some zeros, but these are algorithms where we do nothing about the zeros. We don't do anything special. Whereas in the partial differential equation, the whole algorithm was arranged to exploit the zero structure. We explicitly, in the iterative algorithms, only iterated effectively over the non-zero elements of the matrix. So one obvious remark, which I probably made before, is that it is, of course, even slow. That you can never. It's not useful to test if a matrix element is zero, because it takes longer to test normally than it does to do a floating point operation. When A times B is usually faster than if A equals naught, because an if statement causes a branch which destroys your pipeline, and therefore your computer would tend to run slower. So the only way you can exploit zero structure is not by testing dynamically if it's zero. It is by arranging the computation to see if it is to exploit the zeros. That, of course, was not true on old computers. In the good old days, when computers took a long time to do a floating point operation, it was much faster to test on zero than it was to do a floating point operation. On the Cosmic Cube, the 8087 took several hundred machine cycles to do a floating point operation, and it had no pipeline in the instruction stream. So you actually gained on machines of that architecture a lot by testing on zero. You do not gain anything on current machines, because they can do a floating point operation, in fact several per clock cycle. So the first example of full matrices is chemistry. So chemistry has a lot of problems which involve matrices. That's because chemistry has a so-called scattering or energy operator, and a large number of computations in chemistry correspond to operations on the scattering operator or energy operator relating states. Where these states might label the type of molecule, the different positions of electrons in the molecule, the number of electrons, their orbits, the vibrational modes, etc. So there are various types of operations one needs in chemistry. So a very common thing you do in chemistry is to find eigenvalues and eigenstates. We discussed eigenvalues and eigenstates. Those are the vectors such that when you take the matrix and operate on it, you get an exact multiple of the state or the vector. And the eigenvalues of an operator or an energy function in chemistry are the precise states you're interested in. They're the bound states or eigenstates of the system. And there are a large number of computations that involve calculating such eigenstates and eigenvalues. And often the matrix, although it actually has quite a few zeros, is usually assumed to be a full matrix. And the reason you're doing this is you'll want to find the actual so-called wave function or density, which is effectively the electron density for a particular molecule, that can never be found exactly. The only way you can find it is numerically, by solving so-called Schrödinger's equation, which is a particular differential operator. It happens to be done by a so-called perturbation theory, but that's, I don't think that's too important. All right. So as I've mentioned, I think before, another major use, actually, which use is somewhat disappearing, although slowly, of full matrices is computational electromagnetics. Computational electromagnetics is used in several fields. Well, it's calculating Maxwell's equations, which is effectively the so-called which is effectively a so-called spectral method of solving a differential equation. Namely, if so that's if you look at your this file, this is meant to illustrate what computational electromagnetics involves. So typically, in order to solve a differential equation, we look to various ways of doing it, which are typically by discretizing the equation. So another way of solving it is to expand it in functions. Actually, Fourier transforms is one example. And they often actually provide very simple solutions if you do that. However, for general, from complex equations like you get in electromagnetism, that doesn't work. So you have to use functions for which you get rather complicated results. So you expand in terms of some basis functions. Now, if you happen to know the eigenfunctions of this operator, then the answer, you would immediately know what was going on, but essentially in any interesting problem, you do not know the eigenfunctions. So if you do a general expansion in terms of functions, here's a Maxwell's equation, which is essentially a wave equation at the top there. That's the simplest Maxwell equation. So we do an expansion, and what we want to do is to make certain this expansion, we want the coefficients of these chosen expansion functions f of n, which could be illustrated by a solution of a simple version of the equation, you want to find those coefficients in some fashion. So you'd like this expansion to satisfy that the expansion minus the right-hand side is zero. That's as it's a finite expansion, that will not be true. So what you do is you minimize the difference between the expansion and the right-hand side, and you do that by essentially calculating, choosing a set of wave functions and integrating over the region for the differential equation, the wave function times this residual, and putting it equal to naught, and effectively this becomes a matrix equation where this matrix is just gotten by integrating the wave functions times the differential operator times the expansion function, which is this thing given here. So the solution of the differential equation reduces to solving this matrix equation. So this matrix equation is almost always going to be a full matrix because we've lost, in this approach we've done, we've lost all this natural nearest neighbor structure. Our expansion functions are just some odd function, and nothing, not necessarily anything special to do with the equation. There is no reason why all those integrals aren't non-zero, and so you naturally get four matrices with every element non-zero. So this method is certainly not only applicable to computational electromagnetics, it just happens to be used very commonly in that case. So one comment we have here is that the computational electromagnetic, this so-called method of moments, is extremely expensive. Because if you expand in terms of n functions, and you invert the matrix or solve the equations, the amount of work goes like n cubed. On the other hand, if I take the differential equation and discretize it with n grid points, with the very best methods, I can get a solution which goes like n, and even with the not so good methods, I have solutions that go like n squared. So these are extremely inefficient methods compared to classic or the finite difference methods. The reason you use them is that for this class of problem, electromagnetic problems, finite differences works very badly, or at least can work very badly. The reason being that for the wave equation, the solution oscillates, because they're waves, and waves oscillate. Whereas for Laplace's equation, which is the problem we use, Laplace's equation has slowly varying functions, very smooth. So the wave equation has wavy solutions, and if you do finite difference on wavy solutions, it's not terribly surprising you might get relatively unreliable answers, especially if you have to solve over a large region. So it has been found by experience that these spectral methods or method of moments are much more reliable than finite difference approaches. And so the dominant way of solving Maxwell's equations was by using such spectral methods using direct solution of the matrix equations. Even though the computational work is very high. And the number of, this actually, I think it hasn't changed a lot. The number of equations you get from this can get up to about 50,000. So you're solving 50,000 by 50,000 full matrices, which are quite big matrices. So you're expanding your solution in terms of 50,000 unknown functions. And you need that complexity if you're trying to find, if you're trying to design an aircraft which is has so-called stealth properties, to represent the full structure of the aircraft and make certain your answers reliable, you'll need a pretty accurate expansion, because you obviously wish to make the radar cross-section small everywhere, and it would be embarrassing if you admitted some hot spot which was very small and therefore not represented properly by your expansion. Another area where this type of approach is used is design of high-frequency analog circuits like you have in, cellular pagers and cellular phones, to try to estimate the electromagnetic noise in the system. And so Motorola does a lot of computational electromagnetics in the part of the business that makes pagers, because they want to make they want to be able to make certain that their circuits don't have unnecessary radiation. So I won't go through this particular, well, it's sort of trivial actually. So if I come back to chemistry, I explained why I wanted to solve eigenvalues problems in chemistry. You essentially get matrix problems for the same reason that you do for computational electromagnetics. They come from solving the differential equations of chemistry after you do expansions in terms of various functions. So that gives you matrix equations, just as it did in computational electromagnetics. The other thing you do is you do get matrix multiplications. Chemistry is about the only problem where you get full matrix multiplication. And you don't usually get that as the full part of the problem, but if you have an expansion in terms of one set of functions, and you wish to change the set of functions which you want to expand in terms of, which is called changing the basis set, which you actually often want to do in chemistry, because the different basis sets are appropriate at different times, you will find out if you track through the indices, that that corresponds to full matrix multiplication. So this is the summary of this. So we found that full matrices have a few important examples. They're not terribly common. I forgot to mention for computational electromagnetics, people are replacing the full matrix algorithm by much faster methods, because they need to actually, the problem is that the 50,000, the number 50,000 of expansion functions is actually not sufficient to get an accurate answer for a complex vehicle or aircraft, and you need actually to go to much larger matrices if you use the method of moments, and that becomes rapidly infeasible given a solution method that goes like n cubed. So people have designed actually much better algorithms recently using the so-called fast multiple methods. And I believe those will replace the method of moments in computational electromagnetics. But still, I believe it's extensively used in the real world today and technically pretty important. So now in chemistry, full matrix eigenvalues are very important. Multiplication is seen somewhat, and equation solving is seen somewhat. So when we study full matrices, we're doing something which is actually, in terms of practical computational science, of secondary importance to solving sparse matrices. Although it's of non-trivial importance, namely, it's something that's important and has several applications, they're just not nearly as pervasively important as sparse matrices. And matrix multiplication, which I think is actually getting used less than it used to be, is actually a very rarely used algorithm. There are very few cases where you want to do full matrices, where those matrices, and multiply them where those matrices are big. You often multiply small matrices as part of subproblems, a few 5x5 matrices or something like that. But to multiply 10,000 by 10,000 matrices together and use parallel algorithms to, need parallel algorithms to do that is a relatively uncommon need. So we are now, after all those caveats, which basically says life isn't quite as important as one might have thought, we will study these full matrix algorithms and focus on full matrix multiplication. And so we're going to do C equals A times B. Now you can have rectangular matrices. A and B do not have to be square, but there is no essential difference between rectangular and square matrices. So we'll assume they're square. So the decomposition we're going to use is actually illustrated on the next foil. We're going to decompose our matrices into rectangular subblocks. Because that's the most elegant and actually, at least asymptotically, the most efficient algorithm. And so we're going to assume n processors, and we'll assume that those n processors are arranged as a root n by root n array. And we'll consider only the case where n is a perfect square. Obviously, you can consider cases where it's not a perfect square, but that only makes, it doesn't actually alter any essential features, it just makes the algebra more complex. So this is, so we divide, so if we have 16 processors arranged as a 4x4 grid, we'll divide the matrix into 16 parts with 1/16 of the matrix in each processor, and we're going to assume A, B, and C all have the same decomposition. I believe this actually is not the optimal algorithm. There is an algorithm which is a little more complex, which does a three-dimensional decomposition, not a two-dimensional decomposition. It does reduce the amount of communication time. That algorithm was only actually discovered a few years ago, about maybe 3 to 5 years ago. When we wrote our book in 1988, we thought the square decomposition was the most efficient. Although if we thought about it more carefully, we would have noticed that other parts of our book proved otherwise, but so be it. So we'll assume that the matrices are big M by big M, that we divide them up into little m by little m blocks, so that each processor has an m by m subblock and are labeled by a two-vector L and K. And sometimes we use a C notation where they run from 0 to root n minus 1, and sometimes a Fortran notation where the processors are labeled 1 to root n. So this foil here illustrates the decomposition. We have a matrix here, and the same decomposition is done for A, B, and C. Here we're labeling it as we would in C, starting at 0. So we have blocks which are 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 2, 0, 3, going up to 3, 3. Each processor has one of these subblocks. There is actually, if you read your books on matrices, there is a theory of submatrices which correspond to taking matrices and dividing up into subblocks. If you read that theory, you will find that all the matrix formulae, when you think about them in terms of block matrices, these subblock matrices, you get the same formulae you did before, except you replace the matrix elements by the matrix blocks and do matrix-matrix multiplication rather than element-element multiplication. So in terms of blocks, the formula for the matrix C-hat is the same as it used to be, namely CLK equals ALN BNK summed over N, which is the classic matrix multiplication formula, except normally C, A, and B are matrix elements. Here they're these blocks, and what you have here is not just multiplication of numbers, it's actually matrix multiplication of these little m by little m blocks which you have in each processor. Alright, so there are a bunch of references. This one here by Agarwal et al. Is the one that gives the best algorithm which replaces these previous algorithms as being more efficient. There's also other papers which describe it. There's one in my journal, Concurrency Practice and Experience. So there are two algorithms. There's the one that we introduced, or probably reinvented in our book, and there's another one associated with Canon. These algorithms are not essentially different. Given it's not a terribly dramatically important algorithm, I don't think it's worth worrying about the differences. So if you examine that formula for the matrix C, you will find that it cannot be trivially done. I mean, there's natural parallelism. I mean, if I'm calculating, if I'm doing matrix multiplication, the parallelism is obvious, because each matrix element of C can be calculated independently of all other matrix elements. So if I have stored matrix C and decomposed it so that the processors have an equal number of matrix elements, then rather clearly I can get a natural parallel algorithm where each processor calculates using the owner computes rule all the matrix elements of C that are assigned to it. So matrix multiplication is a classic owner computes rule parallel algorithm, where the processor in charge of a given matrix element does the work involved in updating it. By updating, I mean incrementing it, because the basic formula for the final matrix C hat is just the sum over matrix products of subblocks. Alright. So rather than look at this formal pseudocode, it's best to look at the examples. So if you stare at the formula for C hat, you will find that C hat LK is, as I said, ALN, sum of N of A hat LN, B hat and K. So, although the parallelism is obvious, there is essentially always communication, because with exception of a few processors, the processors do not have the correct values of A hat and B hat to be able to do the multiplication. So the implementation of matrix multiplication consists of a classic loosely synchronous algorithm. Remember, loosely synchronous are typified, or block synchronous are typified by compute cycles. You communicate what's needed for this iteration, then you do the computation, and then you do the next iteration. For this problem here, the number of cycles is root n for n processes. So if you examine the formula, you will find that it is really very straightforward. So let's look at C hat 0 0. C hat 0 0, the first term is A hat 0 0, B hat 0 0. So that's very easy to do, because A hat 0 0 and B hat 0 0 are in the processor. In that process already, because we're assuming the same decomposition for A hat, B hat, and C hat. So this computation, multiplying A hat 0 0 by B hat 0 0, is straightforward. Now let's look at the term n equals 0 in the next processor. So the next processor, it's A hat 0 0 times B hat 0 1 has to be added into C hat 0 1. So that's not quite so satisfactory, because this processor has B hat 0 1, but it does not have A hat 0 0. So we must obviously communicate A hat 0 0 from this processor to that processor. So if we look at the other terms, in the n equals 0 case, we'll find that n equals 0 has A00, all along the first row of processors, multiplied into the elements of B hat that are already stored in the processor. If we look at the next row, it's A hat 11 multiplies into the elements of B hat that are already stored in the processor. So in this communicate compute cycle, the communication we have to do is a simple broadcast along the rows of the matrix. So you must send A hat 00 along so that all matrices in the row know about A hat 00. So the first step is what you would call a subgrid or a subcube broadcast or a multicast, where you do not broadcast to all processors, but you send A hat 00 from here to three other processors, A hat 11 from here to the three other processors, A hat 22 here and two others, A hat 33 to three others. So, as I mentioned already, matrix multiplication is one of the nicest examples of sub-grid or sub-processor grid broadcast, where you want to do broadcast over a limited set of processors. So the first step is broadcast along rows and then do the multiplication. So what happens for the n equals 1? So if we look at n equals 1, we will find that for n equals 1, the time n equals 1, we will have to do a broadcast of A. In this time here, for n equals 1, it's going to be on the first row of processors A hat 0, 1, the second row A hat 1, 2, third row A hat 2, 3, and so on. So we need to do a broadcast of A. But we will now also have to do some communication with B. And so we want, say, here, which used to have B hat 0, 0, we need to have B hat 1, 0. So B hat 1, 0 actually was stored in this processor. So what you have to do if you examine it is you get exactly the right arrangement if you move all the B hats up one in the column. So this algorithm says broadcast the A's along rows and roll up or move up cyclically the B's in the column. So actually B hat 0, 0 reappears at the bottom, and B hat 1, 0 here, B hat 2, 0 here, and so on. And that algorithm then generalizes for, and well, it's written out here. This is the n equals 1 term. T is the result of the broadcasting of A. B is the result of rolling B. And then here's what happens when you add in the next term in C. And you just proceed with this algorithm. So this particular foil here just goes through the four stages of this algorithm, and it goes through the a particular term C21 in C, and shows how you first, these are the broadcast terms, these are the rolled elements of B, and then you see how C gradually accumulates till it gets to the right answer. Given the time, I think we will skip through these quite interesting foils here. So let me just explain qualitatively what the next sort of 8 or 9 foils do. So what they do is they give some sort of MPI version of this algorithm. And the reason why there's a long discussion is that to implement this in the most elegant fashion in MPI, we need to notice the fact that our processors are labeled, and that to get the most elegant algorithm, we need to label our processors in a two-dimensional grid, which means that we need to convert our one, and whereas in MPI, processors are typically labeled in a one-dimensional grid. And so there's a whole set of Cartesian topology routines in MPI which allow you to set up labelings in two dimensions, and which can then be used to support these broadcasts along the rows and the columns, which are just the two axes in the dimensions. So what these foils do is they describe these Cartesian functions. Remember, MPI had 129 functions and PDM had half a dozen, whatever it is. So one of the reasons is you illustrate here with all these neat Cartesian topology subroutines which add function and but complexity to the language. Sorry, to the communication subsystem. So this is some sort of pseudocode for MPI matrix multiplication. I say all those previous foils tell you about the Cartesian create function in MPI, and you see what we do. We iterate over root n iterations, where n is the number of processors. We do not have to do anything on the first iteration with B. So you broadcast A along the appropriate element of A along rows, storing it in a temporary matrix T. You then increment C by T times B. Then you roll B upwards in the way we discussed by one index in this processor labeling. We can store the results of the row on top of the old values of B, because the roll, because we're going to keep on rolling by one, so we actually want the latest value of B, not the old value of B. So we override B in our roll, but we don't want to override A, because when we broadcast it, we'll wipe out the native element of A in that processor. So for rolling, we can override. For broadcasting, we need a temporary. So this foil, second foil here, shows you how to do the broadcast and the roll, and it does it in hopefully the most elegant fashion. It's ingeniously set up a set of, it's used the groups, the communication groups you can set up in MPI to link the, when we broadcast along a row, we just define a group, a group associated with each row, and then we can use this MPI broadcast routine, but instead of broadcasting over the entire world, which is the default, we broadcast over a communicator, which is defined to be the set of rows associated with this, with the row of processors which this particular processor is on. So we can use a single routine broadcast with a communicator, which communicator is set up here by this MCART sub routine called. For the roll, we do this Cartesian shift version of routine in MPI, and then we do this the send-receive, which is the classic MPI algorithm, which allows the processor to receive the rolled value of B from the processor below it and send the rolled value of B to the processor above it. These are obviously not complete codes, but they illustrate how matrix multiplication would look like in MPI and how we use the basic classic MPI routine, send, receive, broadcast, supplemented by these Cartesian topologies. I'm also going to skip the next set of foils, and we'll just stop here. I mean, we'll stop here. We'll discuss this one. All right. So, so if you're thinking about writing a compiler, the algorithm I described illustrates a pretty difficult compiler challenge, because I have developed a very efficient algorithm in the following sense. Because whenever I do the broadcast or the roll of B, I am doing it for m squared elements. Remember, we're sawing little m by little m subblocks in each processor. And I've managed to find an algorithm or a way of thinking about the algorithm so that I do the communication in one fell swoop for all those m squared elements. And so, as you may remember, latency is a big problem in communication. You do not wish to communicate small numbers of elements. You want to communicate a lot of elements. And so this algorithm has basically found the maximal number of elements that you can communicate at a time, which is m squared. And the reason why matrix multiplication is such an efficient algorithm on most parallel machines is that you can arrange the communication so that the amount of stuff communicated at the time is very big, it's m squared. If you think back to Laplace's iteration, any two processors only exchange the edge points of the domain. So if you had an m by m domain of grid points in each processor, the message size was not m squared, it was m, because that's the number of points on the edge. So a critical difference between matrix multiplication and classic PDE solvers is that the communication is in big blocks, m squared. And that means that the startup time is negligible. So that means that some extremely lousy computers run matrix multiplication very well, because their startup is unimportant. So if you want to make networks of PCs and things like that, which might otherwise have poor startup because of Ethernet or ATM drivers, you should use matrix multiplication to convince your sponsor to buy it, because it will look best, because it has such a low latency, which is usually very big for such a what I call informal supercomputers, is unimportant typically for matrix multiplication because of the large messages. Alright, so if you look at there is some rather irrelevant startup terms here. Root n minus 2 is 2 for n equals 4. If we took our large matrices, n might be thousands here, so these startup terms are irrelevant. So basically the total communication time is 2m squared. The total calculation time is 2m cubed. So if we add all that together and ignore this root n term here, we can find the total compute time, we can calculate the efficiency, we can calculate the overhead, because the overhead is normal, which is 1 over efficiency minus 1. Remember, I think we discussed earlier, overhead is always a nicer thing to calculate than efficiency, because overhead is always linear in the parallel terms, which in this case here is the communication time divided by the calculation time. So matrix multiplication has the essential term here is a typical communication time per word divided by m, where we store m by m submatrix in each processor, divided by tcalc. So this form is quite interesting for the following reason. because I said matrix multiplication is quite different from Laplace's equation, but if you did Laplace's equation in two dimensions and looked at the formula we got for performance there, you'll find the performance is identical. Namely, for Laplace's equation, in the simplest algorithm, the overhead is also t com over the number of points on the edge of a region times t cal. Exactly the same formula. However, as I pointed out, it's really, although the overhead is the same, the algorithms have an important difference. For Laplace's equation, the communication goes like m, and the computation goes like m squared, because you do an update of each point. And for a matrix multiplication, the communication goes like m squared and the computation goes like m cubed. So the communication and computation are m times more important for matrix multiplication than they are for a classic iterative algorithm. And that feature is the one that means the startup effects and overheads like that are irrelevant for matrix multiplication, because m squared is usually a big number, but often extremely important for PDE solvers, because m, which is the typical communication message size, can often be a small number compared to startups. So although the ratio of communication time to computation time when you ignore startup is the same for the two problems, matrix multiplication in practice will behave a lot better on most practical computers and make lousy computers look wonderful. And whereas Laplace's equation is a much more sensitive test as to the excellence of your parallel computer and how good your communication network is, because it really does test for latency in the messaging. For compilers, matrix multiplication is more challenging, because if you take somebody's classic code written out in terms of matrix elements and you just parallelize it using the owner computes rule, you would actually do a communication. You would tend to do your communication in single words at a time if you're not careful. So matrix multiplication is an example where there's a great benefit from the compiler analysis, which allows you to find out how much information can be blocked into a message, because you can actually block m squared into actually 2m squared, because you can block all the a's and then you can block all the b's, and then you have enough in your in each processor to just do a classic in-processor matrix-matrix multiplication. So remember, again, coming back to Laplace's equation, there again we had communicate-compute cycles. We had a very different actual sort of structure, because to get Laplace's equation to work right, we had to set up these guard rings so that we could fetch the neighboring processor's information into guard rings, these extra matrix, extra grid points around the edge, so that we had an m by m in each processor. We actually defined, in the simplest case, an m by 2 by m by 2 array in each processor so that the communication could beat the guard rings. Then we did our computation. So we see that the matrix multiplication has some similarities and some differences. In both cases, blocking is important. In the case of matrix multiplication, there are no guard rings necessary. That doesn't make any sense, because you're just setting up new submatrices. The net result of the overhead is comparable, and the result that always intrigued me was the fact that at the end of all this, you got this overhead which went like 1 over the square root of the grain size, where n is the amount of matrix elements stored in each processor. And that sort of was neat, because it said that you got a formula that the overhead went like the t com over t cap divided by grain size to the 1 over the dimension for systems of dimension d, and then matrices, which didn't have any nearest neighbor structure, did look as though they had two-dimensional, which is nice, because matrices, if you write them out, are two-dimensional. So it says that the, so that's why I used to call this the system dimension. Namely, nearest neighbor problems have a natural geometrical dimension of two. Matrices have no locality, because we're doing communication over rows and columns. There's no locality. But they still, in spite of having no locality, look like a two-dimensional problem. So I see that as quite sort of intriguing. I don't know how. And there are other examples, if you read my papers, where you see the same effect. So the last thing I'll mention is Cannon's algorithm. And Cannon's algorithm is essentially the same as the algorithm we just described, except that it does some initial movement of the matrix A hat around, so that instead of doing broadcasts of A, it does rolls of A as well. So it moves A hat around, so that the basic algorithm is roll A, roll B, compute, roll A, roll B, compute, roll A, roll B, compute. So you do that root n minus 1 times. As far as I know, I think it's actually slightly less, it involves more communication time than the other algorithm, because the broadcast is typically as efficient as rolling, and Cannon's algorithm requires initial communication to be done to set up A hat in the right fashion. But on some machines, and possibly for some compilers or some examples, it might be a better algorithm. And I'll stop there. These lecture notes are actually not complete, because they don't really discuss LU decomposition properly. But let me just, I probably mentioned this already, but let me just finish by spending one foil discussing parallel matrix inversion or LU decomposition, which are essentially the same thing. When you go from matrix multiplication to LU decomposition, you actually find an algorithm, whereas matrix multiplication is an algorithm you choose to make your computer look good. LU decomposition is pretty hard to make your computer look good. It tends to have very high overhead. The reason is that in matrix multiplication, I could always arrange the problem to do all my communication as n squared matrices. When you do LU decomposition, you will find it's just like Laplace's equation. The basic operation in matrix inversion is only processing a single row at a time, and that row then does something on a sub-block matrix. And so you'll find that although actually, again, the ratio of communication to compute, the overall ratio, ignoring latency, is about the same, the basic operations only can be blocked to block m elements together, where m is you start m by m matrix elements in each processor. So matrix inversion is extremely sensitive to startup effects, and so it tends to be quite hard to write efficient algorithms. And it gets even harder when you go to so-called banded matrices and things like that. There was another point I've already mentioned, which is illustrated here, which is straightforward to circumvent, namely you can't use simple, whereas for matrix multiplication you can use simple block decompositions in one or two dimensions. In LU decomposition, where you basically start on row 0, eliminate it, then row 1, and then row 2, and so on, if you did a trivial decomposition, you'll find that processor 0 has nothing to do after you've eliminated, in this case, the first 25% of the rows. However, you can use simple cyclic decomposition to get load balancing. So you need, and you can, of course, for matrix multiplication, also use cyclic decomposition, because there is no locality in any matrix operation. Matrices are two-dimensional, but they're not local, because they're row and column oriented. All operations in matrices, they know about the number of dimensions, they do not know about any locality. I mean, the fact that one row is called one and the other row, next row is called two, has no significance, because I can always permute two with row n and get n in the second position. So there is no locality, and so cyclic decompositions, which then do lead to load balanced algorithms, are quite satisfactory. All right, so that's the end of this class. You're meant to give me a project. There's no way I will do anything until Wednesday week, because I'm basically away for the next week. We have a conference on Java for scientific computing Monday and Tuesday next week, and so I will not exist till Wednesday. We have a conference on Java on the 16th and 17th, and then we have I then rejoin the land of the living on the 18th. So I will not, then inconceivable, I won't even think before the 18th. So you should bear that in mind in planning your life. So thank you for coming to these lectures. There's some evaluation sheets you're meant to fill in there. And have a good Christmas. Thank you.